This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman for a suite of professional-grade products from Protocol for Life Balance, which play a central role in helping support optimal immune function. MyCell Immune Plus, Vitamin C 1000 Plus Zinc 15, and Vitamin D3 in a variety of potencies and delivery systems, liquid, chewable, and soft gels. They're only available from healthcare practitioners, but they're available to you at drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance for more information and to order. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, one of my favorite hours of the week, which affords me an opportunity to share vital information with you with my good colleague, Layla Mudin, who's our nutritionist in residence. Each week we team up with our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the destination for questions. radioprogram@AOL.com. We've got some great questions this week. How are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good, good. Sort of transitioning to fall.
And, oh, my goodness. Yeah. Already. And, here we are.
And yesterday, you know, I did a very interesting podcast with Neil Levin of Protocol for Life Balance. And it was interesting.
Yes.
And you know, for you, it's a little bit of a busman's holiday to listen to these podcasts because you know it all already. But actually, it might, you know, if you're doing your yoga or, you know, washing the dishes or doing some chores, paying some bills, you know, maybe listen to that one because he has some very interesting insights on vitamin D and zinc and astragalus and mushrooms for immunity. You know, we've been sort of body slammed with fall here in the Northeast. Really quite chilly temperatures this weekend. And, you know, I'm not used to this kind of whipsaw transition.
Came a little soon, right?
Yeah, there's sort of an Indian summer. Usually, you know, September can be a really warm month. In fact, unpleasantly so, but it was really quite cold. So I really got an opportunity to test out my riding gear and my wetsuit this weekend. Water temperature is 69, which is a little too chilly for just, you know, skin suits. So I wore my wetsuit in the water and tested. And it was really quite, I had the whole, the full Monty because I did the gloves, the hood, the booties.
Wow.
You know, I had it all going on. And it was really quite comfortable in the water. So I feel that with the pools closed, that's an alternative for me.
So it was up to snuff?
It really works. And then
Is it worth the hour and a half that it takes to put on?
that's part of the workout. You know, it's like by the time I have my gear on, I'm huffing and puffing. The other thing is it's so tight. You know, you have to pull the elastic up and you're like, and sometimes you punch yourself in the face. You know, your hand slips and it's like, oh, whap. You know, so it's also a little bit of a pugilistic workout, you know, when you don't even, it's socially distanced because I don't have a partner and I just hit myself in the face.
You really self-entertain so well.
Yeah, I do. I mean, you got to be resourceful in these pandemic times. And
exactly.
Speaking of self-entertaining, and this is, you know, I'm going to do a little bit of a U-turn on that subject because we're going to talk about, for a moment before we take our questions, the effects of loneliness on our health. You know, one of the unforeseen consequences of COVID-19 is that, you know, we're isolating, and especially the seniors are isolating. And there's an interesting story coming to us from endocrinologynetwork.com. That's I guess that's the website of all the endocrinologists, the people who deal with thyroid problems and, you know, but they got an interesting article here. Feelings of loneliness in older adults tied to increased risk of new onset diabetes.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's a European study. It's done out of King's College in London. A strong relationship between loneliness and the onset of type 2 diabetes. And this also coincides with an interesting statistic is that deaths from Alzheimer's disease have spiked during COVID-19, and I'm not talking about deaths from people with Alzheimer's disease getting COVID-19.
Right.
But, you know, acceleration towards death of people with Alzheimer's disease and dementia, there's definitely a spike in the statistics. And this may be part of it. They looked at a bunch of participants who were diabetes-free, and they followed them for 12 years. And they actually filled out detailed questionnaires about their living circumstances. The investigators found out that living alone and social isolation had an impact on diabetes incidence. Interesting.
Hmm.
So, what could be the possible mechanisms? You know, well, if you're living alone and
lack of stimulation,
you don't exercise, or perhaps you use food to console yourself, or perhaps it's the cortisol, you know, high levels of cortisol may be associated with elevation in blood sugar or breakdown in increase in insulin resistance. You know, here's the unintended consequence of this is that this lockdown and the sequestration of our older population may inadvertently lead to increased risk of them dying of COVID-19, because we know that an important comorbidity for COVID is blood sugar abnormalities and diabetes.
Yeah.
So, wow.
You know what else, Dr. Hoffman, that occurs to me? It could be a lack of access to caregivers because people don't want to come out.
Yes.
I've got an example right here close to home. Mm-hmm. I have an elderly aunt. She's in her 90s. This is my mother's older sister, whose caregiver has diabetes, so she hasn't been coming to see her or care for her at all.
Wow.
Yeah.
So these people may be afraid to go to the doctor, or maybe they don't have the wherewithal to go to the doctor, or they don't have the proper supervision, because if somebody had been with them, that, you know, like a spouse, can say, George, I don't like how you're looking. You're looking kind of pallid and you lost your appetite. I think you need to go to the doctor right now. And if you live alone in isolation, you don't have that. That can be an important survival mechanism, having a spouse or spousal equivalent who can, support your health.
Yes.
Unless they do the opposite, unless they're a pain in the you-know-what and they undermine your health. That can happen, too.
That can happen, too. That would be called a toxic relationship.
Right.
Yeah.
Which also gets magnified during sequestration, because it's kind of like, that play, No Exit,
Exactly. Right. Well, we do know that rates of domestic violence, child abuse, all of these have gone up.
Yeah.
So
these are the unintended consequences, we have to sort of balance it. Well, you know, we want to protect ourselves from the virus, but on the other hand, you know, there's not just economic devastation, but there's health devastation that's occurring. So we need a balanced response. All right. We've been on that theme before. Let's move on to questions. Radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions. Batter up.
Okay. We've got one here. From Janine. I've had fibromyalgia since 1992 as a result of a car accident.
Wow.
I've tried many medications.
Wait a minute. Well, let's do the math on that. 1992, that's 30 years. What was I doing in 1992? Well, I had just moved over to, I think, WOR Radio. Actually, I'd already been there. So I was doing radio. I was early in my practice. I was in my 30s. Actually, I just turned 40 in 1992. So,
Okay. So, since the result of a car accident, I've had fibromyalgia since 92. I've tried many meds and found I felt worse taking them. So, around 1995, since 95, I've not taken any prescription medications. I do have a reduced thyroid function, however, but I don't take anything for that either.
Whoa, hold it.
That
can certainly be part of that, because there is a syndrome of excess bodily pain associated with hypothyroidism. I happen to know that condition quite intimately, because it's called Hoffman syndrome, not named after me, but it's the syndrome of pain associated with hypothyroidism. So, addressing thyroid problems. It's not a, you know, panacea, yeah. But it yeah. is something that could be part of supporting someone with fibromyalgia. Right. So, you know, why, I mean, this person doesn't want to take medication, but thyroid medication is replacing something that the body makes. So it's in the best tradition of medicine is that, you know, when you're exactly. insufficient in something, you want to get back to normal levels.
It's replacement. Yeah. It's replacement. Well, there's more. Janine says, I'm 82 and an active gardener and community member. It Great. Seems the more active physically and mentally I am, the less pain I have.
Duh.
Might be all psychological.
No. It's not. I mean, yes, there is a brain thing, but, you know, there really is something about the bell curve for yes. bodily aches and pains when it comes to exercise. I mean, obviously, too much exercise and you're going to be sore. Not right. enough exercise and you're going to be achy. So, mm-hmm. you know, and especially as you get older, and I don't know if you've reached that point because you're younger than I am, but there's a certain sweet spot between inactivity and hyperactivity where, you know, your body feels the best because, you know, there's always going to be something, you know, when you're right. past the age of 60.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's, well, I suppose. I'm not past the age of 60 yet. No. However, I wonder about an 82-year-old and thyroid replacement.
Yeah. Well, you have to be extremely cautious in an 82-year-old, yeah. but it can be done judiciously. And, mm-hmm. You know, we have, you know, many of our patients on proper and safe thyroid replacement. So, you know, that's part of it.
Right.
Yes, let's look at some of the nutrients, magnesium.
She's taking magnesium, vitamin D.
Good.
And some collagen.
Good. Hmm. Ribose, yeah. curcumin, you know, yes. and it's not just about supplements. Some of our patients with fibromyalgia do better with hormone replacement, not just thyroid, but, you know, sometimes natural hormones. It's a little bit tricky to start that at 82, but sometimes a little bit of DHEA can have a beneficial effect on bodily aches and pains. So CBD also may be helpful and is safe in an 82-year-old because it's not like it's not going to make her disoriented like pot. You know, these are some of the things that can be helpful, like even a topical CBD that you rub into the skin and that penetrates the skin. You know, these are some of the things. Low-dose naltrexone for some patients with fibromyalgia can be very effective. You know, these are SPM, fish oil as natural anti-inflammatories.
What about things like body work, massage, acupuncture?
Obviously. Oh, absolutely.
Anything like that. Absolutely. They could all work. Kind of synergistically, right?
You know, gentle massage, gentle touch. But, you know, I like her workaround, which is to remain active.
Yes.
And movement. And, you know, generally, I got to say, I mean, these days I'm pretty active and, you know, most days I'm doing something. But it takes me a little while to limber up in the morning. You know, I have to stretch out. And, you know, sometimes I wake up, stiff from the previous day's exertion.
Right.
And, you know, it just sort of takes a while to unlimber the body and, you know, some stretching, you know, get down on the mat, do some stuff or, you know, do some squats or leg extensions. You know, these are things that help the body, you know, resist the kind of stiffness and achiness that, you know, usually just develops by default if you don't do anything.
Right. Keeps the joints lubricated and all of that. I know that's something that yoga is very good for, keeping the joints lubricated, keeping cerebrospinal fluid moving, things like that.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Janine, we hope you feel better soon. Wow. 82 on no meds. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, look, that in itself is an accomplishment.
Okay. Well, Dr. Hoffman, you know your recent article, Brain Robbers?
Yeah.
Well, Vicky has written in a suggestion, an edit.
Okay.
Dear Dr. Hoffman, in your most recent newsletter, you have the following paragraph. Quote, one-third of the participants were taking anticholinergic drugs with an average of 4.7 anticholinergic drugs taken per person. Metoprolol, atenolol, loratadine. Bupropion were the most common. And Vicky says, as far as I could tell, and having double-checked my memory with the literature search, loratadine, which is Claritin, and bupropion, which is Wellbutrin, are not anticholinergics.
Yeah.
You don't explicitly say they are, but the position of the list implies that they are among the 4.7.
Am I
mistaken in this? I'm happy to be corrected.
Thank you for that precision. And in truth, I just quoted the authors. So the blame is with me for just passing along uncritically. The authors included medications that have very weak anticholinergic effects. I mean, anticholinergic effects range from very weak anticholinergic effects to the most profound anticholinergic effects, like, for example, medications like Artane, which are sometimes used for Parkinson's disease, which is very anticholinergic. So the two medications you mentioned, one is Wellbutrin, which is a commonly used antidepressant, and it's a pretty minor anticholinergic. I think it may have very small amount of anticholinergic effects. So it's not going to be a big problem. Same thing with Claritin. It's a non-sedating antihistamine. But the more sedating antihistamines, like Benadryl chlorpheniramine, which is in chlortrimeton, an older-fashioned antihistamine.
Oh, yeah, chlortrimeton. Wow.
Yeah, but they used to knock you out. And so it's used as a – it's not used as a daytime antihistamine. Now they have they use Zizal and Claritin, and these are even sold over the counter. Those are – may have a very, very minor anticholinergic component. Technically anticholinergic, but to a lesser extent. So it's if you want, and you're concerned about your medication, the bottom of the article is a rating of medications according to their anticholinergic potential from slight to medium to strong. And so you can see if any of the medications you're taking, the idea being is that anticholinergics mess with cholinergic pathways in the brain. That has to do with acetylcholine, and therefore is part and parcel of neurotransmission. That it's really a target for a lot of the medications that are used are cholinergic medications, the Alzheimer's medication. They don't work that well.
Yeah.
But we also know that choline and phosphatidylcholine and
acetylcholine,
which are building blocks for acetylcholine. You can't really take a supplement of acetylcholine, but you can boost your acetylcholine by taking choline. And maybe in that article, we should have said, if you really need to be on these medications, maybe you should take some choline,
to help
counteract the adverse effects. But, long term, these effects are not going to be instantaneous, but, you do take one or more of these medications, especially these bladder medications, year in, year out. These can statistically move you more towards dementia. And in the study, they found especially the people who had the APOE4 gene, which is the Alzheimer's susceptibility gene.
Yes.
They really should be advised to exert a special caution taking these medications.
Yeah. Okay.
So check out that article. I think it's a nice – it's actually an article that I wrote in 2018, but there was an update to it because of a new study. So I rehashed the old article with a new introduction.
Yeah. Okay. Vicky, thank you for your note.
Boy, was it a relief not to write about COVID-19 for a week.
Whew. Oh, yeah.
It was very refreshing.
Well, Dr. Hoffman, speaking of COVID-19.
Uh-oh, here we go.
We have
back
two
to reality,
questions.
Unfortunately. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, back to reality. We have two questions, one from Sylvia and one from Bevy, about the flu shot.
Mm-hmm.
And they are both, they've never taken it before. I've never gotten the flu and I've never taken the flu vaccination. Bevy is 63 years old, relies on your advice, eats well, takes supplements to bolster immunity. Now with COVID, I'm considering the flu vaccine for the first time. And Sylvia says, now with COVID an issue, would there be any benefit to getting the flu shot?
Yeah, I'm actually preparing to do on another show. on somebody else's show. I'm a guest on that subject. I think I'm going to do that next week. And yeah, I think it's right. It's the day after Yom Kippur, so it's next Tuesday. And so, you know, we'll provide links to that show when that shows up. And that's what the whole discussion revolves around. You know, the flu, the confluence of the, you know, flu season with COVID-19, and what are the implications of that? So one thing that I'm going to point out is that, you know, because of all our social isolation and masking, you know, we, instead of bracing ourselves for the usual, you know, flumageddon, we may be surprised. Yeah, we may have a very, very mild flu season, because the very flu is transmitted in a way almost identical to the way the coronavirus is transmitted. So if we're exerting the same precautions, and yeah, you know, sure, there's a lot of still some knuckleheads and, you know, people who just, they're just too tired of lockdown to socially distance and wear masks. And they may be a source of transmission. You know, look like on some college campuses, you know, the kids are just, just busting out all over. You know, or some people who are just refuseniks. They just don't want to do it anymore. There may be some patches of transmission, but I think fairly quickly they'll be spotted and the people will be forced back into isolation, or their colleges or their schools or their facilities will be closed down, you know, restaurants and the like. And states will go back to, you know, more severe lockdown if there's a lot of COVID-19. The very same measures to prevent the spread of COVID-19 may prevent the spread of the flu. So that being said, what about the vaccine? Well, you know, as I've said repeatedly,
there'd be a benefit.
Yeah, I'm sort of a flu vaccine agnostic. It's not that effective.
Yeah,
it's not, in my opinion, it's not devastatingly harmful. You know, some people say, you know, vaccines, they got, you know, mercury and aluminum and, you know, but they're...
What about, isn't it true that for a month after you've gotten your flu vaccine, you're a little more vulnerable?
Well, that's actually interesting, because there is an article that points to that. It's based on a study of Army recruits, and specifically with coronaviruses before COVID-19. So related corona, they were more susceptible to coronaviruses. And that article has been touted quite a lot by you know, sort of the anti-vax people. On the other hand, that article, I've seen some legitimate criticisms of that article, that it's not that definitive. It was, you know, too small a study to, for us to base very, very definitive conclusions on. And there's also the counter argument, which has been made, is that when you take a vaccine, almost of any kind, vaccines stimulate the immune system. They actually cause an immune reaction, and they actually contain adjuvants which deliberately stimulate the immune system, because you want the vaccine to take. That may be actually the cause of some side effects, you know, body aches, or in some people, you know, more severe reactions, because they actually have their immune system overstimulated and they feel sick. But what that means, and some people pointed this out, is that certain vaccines may actually confer generalized immunity. So if you take, say, the MMR vaccine, I've heard it proposed that if you take the MMR vaccine, you're going to get some protection, some cross reactivity and protection against the flu, although that's not really been conclusively demonstrated. So you can, you know, argue on both sides that taking the flu vaccine will stimulate your immune system so that you might resist the, I mean, again, that's, I'm not going to stake a claim.
It's almost like, it's almost like you're kind of poking your immune system to say, hey, attention.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know.
So, you know, the other thing to point out is it's not clear what is going to happen when, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Godzilla meets King Kong. You know, we don't know yet, you know, what's, well, we, it's, or a better analogy is like Biden versus Trump. We don't know what's going to happen yet. You know, some people think they know, but nobody really knows. So it's, we don't yet know what happens when it's flu season and COVID-19. And if they, some viruses actually interfere with one another. They may push, the flu may shoulder aside the weaker coronavirus. It's conceivable, but I'm not saying it. It's just a hypothetical possibility.
Right.
The other possibility is that they could be synergistic in a bad way. You know, it's that double whammy. It's like, whoa, you've got COVID-19 and you've got influenza. Oh, those are co-infections, double trouble. But we don't know. And so...
Well, here's another thing. We already know, that the CDC has been saying for a long time, this is pre-pandemic and everything, to lower your risk of getting the flu is to wash your hands. It could reduce your risk by 50%.
There you go.
People are already doing that. So
obsessively.
I would expect the flu is going to be way less.
Yeah. And there's another thing.
Than in prior years.
Behaviorally, fess up. Both of us are guilty of this. You know, we have like a little cold and, we have a bunch of patients waiting in the office. So, in previous years, we'd be like, okay, we're going to maintain a respectful distance and patients come to shake our hands. We say, don't shake my hand because I got
a little. Don't shake my hand. Exactly. Yeah.
But we didn't mask up. We would push ourselves to go to the office. Now, if I have the slightest intimation of being sick, I'm going to not go to the office. I'll take the hit. Okay. I'll cancel the patients. They'll reschedule and, and that's happening.
Instead, something else, right?
That's happening across the board because people are behaving responsibly. And, the flip side of absenteeism, which is a big problem in business, is presentism.
Yeah.
Presentism means people coming in sick and infecting other people and thereby reducing the productivity of the company, or the enterprise.
Yes.
And we're seeing less of that now. You could take the flu shot. I mean, look, I just advise, we both spoke to this guy. We spoke to a diabetic patient. He has type 1 diabetes. He's older. He's had, bypass surgery. His doctor wants to take the flu shot. That's great because you know what happens when you get the flu is your blood sugar goes kablooey. It just goes all over the place. You do not want that to happen. So
these are high risk people
who have COPD. It's then I say do it because the possible slight downside of whatever, adverse effects of the flu vaccine are outweighed by the benefits that it might confer in terms of prevention.
Yeah.
Hey, Layla, we're running a little long on segment one. So preview us part two. What are we going to talk about in part two? Because we're going to pause and divide our podcast into two parts.
Okay. My brother has lost 20 pounds for seemingly no good reason.
Okay.
What's going on here?
All right. Let's consider the possibilities when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today with Layla Mutin, it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. Radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions. Great questions this week. Keep them coming. We'll be right back.